No one's asking Erwin Rommel much of anything anymore.
Well, they're all dead. No, in case anybody listening knows what I'm talking about, Rommel became famous throughout Germany as a brilliant military commander. But then he realized Hitler was going to lead them all to death and destruction. He became part of a coup to kill Hitler that failed. And he was captured, and because of his great history with the country, they gave him the opportunity to kill himself rather than what would have otherwise happened.
Yeah, it was not the last time someone tried to kill Hitler. There was that lovely little suitcase with the bombs that unfortunately didn't take him out. I heard a tank expert who was not that much of a fan of Rommel's. The story that he presented was kind of Rommel was a one-trick pony, and when the British finally figured out a way of getting around his methods, his methods became rather disastrous and failed miserably. So towards the very end of his tank career, he was probably not as successful as he was early on for a bunch of different reasons of tank usage and the types of tanks that the British kind of threw at him at the.
Well, Montgomery defeated him at El Alamein, so he was not impervious.
Hey, Steve DePio, a question with Trump.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Jeff.
No legs for this. Sorry. Hey, Steve DePio, Chris.
Okay. Anyway. In the end, Rommel wasn't unbeatable, unfortunately, for him, and fortunately for us.
All right, enough ancient history.
Okie doke. Well, Jeff left us, unfortunately. Rich, any other comments on this subject or anything else?
No, that's about it, Roy. I think I understand a little bit more about the subject now, and I'll try to figure out what that EFF means on the meter. Back to you.
Okie doke. Once again, I'm AC2GS. This is the Limark Technical Net. If anyone has any amateur radio-related questions, please hit that push to talk. Okay, I guess that's a no. So on we go with non-amateur radio stuff. Wesley?
And to XGN. So I sent you a number of emails, and I sent those emails to Paul, too. So let me start from... Some of them are addressed to you. As a professional in given area, some of them are regarding to space, so I would love Paul to respond to that. So let me start from the first one. October 5th, 2023, new method of detecting cancer. And it is about the blood test, always needed to know about your cancer. So proteins become highly elevated in most cancers, including many of the most common little cancers of the colon, lung, breast, prostate, ovaries, uterus, pancreas, and head and neck. End of quote. Now, there is a second one about that. So it's an ultra-sensitive blood test that detects pan cancer biomarker. The new study leverages single molecule based on detection technology known as CMOA that was developed by the Walt Lab. The test is designed to detect the open reading frame 1 protein ORF1P and transposable element protein that is known to occur in many cancers but not corresponding to normal tissue. Do you have any comment about that, Dr. Ross?
Yes?
Yeah, I think you forgot that I had another radio question. But that's all right. Obviously,
it's K0. Oh, I'm terribly sorry, Ryan. Wesley, you don't mind if we put this on pause for a little while? I'm terribly sorry, Ryan.
Okay, no problem.
Okay, once again, I'm sorry, Ryan. What's your second question?
Yeah, thanks, Senator. My question is, what about the digital modes on C20? I saw thinking about getting rid of some baud rate limits. But if you look at the law, there's no baud rate limit on C20 right now.
Well, I don't know. The packet is kind of hit its heyday about 20 years ago, but I'm aware it's still there. I would think that there's nothing disallowing it. I haven't really checked, but there's not really that much different about, 2 meters or 70 centimeters versus 220. So, my assumption would be that it would be legitimate to use packet radio. The big question is there an agreed-upon band plan where it's cordoned off? You said not, so that might be somewhat of a problem. On the flip side is it's not really used that frequently. So, would anyone really care if you were using something that goes beyond the band plan on 220? So I'd be curious if anyone out there has any idea about using packet on 220, whether it's forbidden or not, please add to our knowledge. Yeah, I could just barely hear that audio, if you could raise the audio somehow.
That was K0BD.
Yes, Ryan.
I was going to say two things. One, there's a guy in Europe who has this thing called New Packet Radio, where he does TCP/IP stack over UHF in Europe. Now, he can't do that in the U.S., obviously, because the bands are the baud rate. But he does full, a couple megs or something a second on packet radio. It's done through a network and computer. So I was wondering if there's no baud rate. 220 would be possible. You might check that out, New Packet Radio, see what that person's doing out in Europe. But I was thinking, what would be possible in terms of bandwidth with 100 kilohertz and no
baud. Well, I don't know. It would be interesting to take a good look into. Again, I haven't really had generally the 220 band, the questions that get asked on the technical net is it still working? Because, people pulled out an old 220 and tuned it up and couldn't hear any traffic going on. So that's a good question. I wish I had a good answer.
Yeah, K0BD. Actually, there's a lot of traffic on 220 on repeaters in New York. There's Hotel Delta Romeo or something. I can't remember the repeater right now, but there's a bunch of repeaters in New York that are C20 that are active. I've had conversations on them, and it sounds so good. It's so crisp and so clear. because there's no interference, I think we should all be doing that.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. I'm going to have to look that up. I know on the good old West Coast, a lot of digital traffic is going on with mesh networks using things like Unify, semi-commercial Wi-Fi transceivers and such. So they're going gangbusters on the West Coast. On the East Coast, I think the problem is that they're not able to get enough people interested to have the required density for a mesh to be functional.
Yes, I keep your...
Yeah, well, another thing I have to Google and look up and learn more about, C20. Okay, thanks, Ryan. Any other comment? Okay, very good, Ryan. Thank you for participating. Thanks to everyone who participates. Anyone else with any amateur radio-related questions before we move on to the non-amateur radio-related questions?
Roy, WB3AB.
Yes, Ed.
Just a question about the last question about high data rates on 220. I've worked on high data rate links. And the main problem seems to be if you're limited, as you mentioned, to 100 kilohertz bandwidth, then depending upon your modulation technique, that more or less defines the maximum data rate to fit into that bandwidth. But my question is much more fundamental. What a ham radio needs to shove that much data so quickly?
Well, it depends what your purposes are. Packets are still being used for exchanging glorified email text messages and small files, graphic images, theoretically video images. You can transfer all kinds of things if you get the symbol rate up high enough. Or you could go back to the bad old days where we had modems that would take the better part of 5 minutes to generate one single low-resolution graphic image.
I think today we can find a happy medium.
Well, but you have to understand that a lot of times tinkerers like to find the boundaries and then push on them and see how far they can push them out to new levels. So, you know, there's always going to be people with not immediately practical ideas of things that they would like to do. And once they somehow accomplish it, other people with more practical ideas kind of go into that space and make it viable. Say again?
Kilowatt zero, bravo, bravo.
Yes, Ryan.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I am that thinker, and that's why I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking about what's possible. You know, images, text messages, emails, GPIP, it's very interesting. I got to check out, but I will say 7-3 and thank you all for the information. Kilowatt zero, bravo, bravo, bravo.
Okay, very good, Ryan. 73. Have a good night, and thank you for participating. Yeah, we need our dreamers. We need people who kind of look at the boundaries and say, I think I can get past that. You know, sometimes they have a way to monetize it. About 99% of the time, they don't. Other people come up with a way to make money off of these things. And then the lawyers get all the money because the guy who figured it out and the guy who monetizes it take each other to court.
Yeah, but that is a fundamental conflict with the ideas of ham radio. Oh, no, there are loads and loads of high data rate systems around with the appropriate bandwidth on a frequency band where you can have that bandwidth. That's old news. But I'm saying, you know, the non-pecuniary interest in ham radio seems to fly in the face of what you're saying.
Not necessarily. I'm talking about technology as a kind of a two-step phenomena that often the guys who make the breakthroughs don't know how to make a profit off of it. In this hobby, you're not supposed to theoretically make a profit off of it, so that's not the problem. Then it just becomes how would I do that? And then you have a bunch of people saying, well, they've never done it before, so they probably can't do it. And then, you know, you think otherwise, and you do it. Sometimes. A lot of times you don't do it. But I was alluding to that aspect only. But, you know, if a thing is possible, not probable, but possible, there's going to be people who try to do it. Just for the sake of saying that they did it.
Understand. But the other side of the coin is, have you ever flown on one of them newfangled flying machines? Especially since 2020?
No, I haven't been in a plane for a while these days.
Because air traffic control went over the ATSB, which is basically very high data rate packet. You know, if you look up Flight Radar 24 or any of those things that's based on airplanes transmitting high data rate packets to air traffic control. There, they spend a lot of effort on just what kind of data rate can you shovel in the allotted bandwidth, which is like 10 megahertz.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of money to be made by packing stuff tighter and tighter to the theoretical constraints. Matter of fact, that's what part of Lightslinger is about. The technology supposedly makes it possible to do a really ridiculous degree of beam forwarding so that you can have the array send one transmission on one frequency in one direction and send a completely different transmission on the same frequency in the opposite or a different direction. And so you increase the amount of data that you can transmit, you know, despite the bandwidth limitations. So, you know, I mean, that's a big thing in technology, to be able to get more and more data over less and less bandwidth in unique, different methods.
You're saying put two independent signals on the exact same carrier frequency, both fully utilizing the allowed bandwidth, is that what I'm hearing?
That's one of the features, supposedly, of Lightslinger. I can't give you the details because the technical articles are behind paywalls. All I can get are the public relations releases.
That reminds me of NBVM, narrowband voice modulation that the ARL was pushing like you wouldn't believe back in the 80s. Is that before your time in amateur radio, or you remember it?
Well, that was before my time. I was an SWL from the mid-60s to the early 70s, and then I got distracted by little things like college and medical school, and I just came back to this 2011.
Well, back around the 80s, there was a big push for reduced bandwidth voice transmissions in amateur radio. It was a big deal. It made it into the ARL handbooks and everything. But it was very, very short and detailed. And then all of a sudden, it just started to slowly disappear and then sunk without a trace.
Well, I mean, this is an ongoing problem. Let me just check. I got the repeater. This is an ongoing problem with bleeding-edge technologies. You know, only a certain non-100% percentage pan out. Some of them fail on cost. Some of them fail out on production. Some of them just fail out because the theory behind them was not quite what they thought it was. And that might be what the end of the light slinger might be. Like I said, they've been playing around with it for 15 years. They seem to be very proud of it. They presented it to their other employees, and it certainly is incredibly different than anything you or I can think of in terms of how an antenna is supposed to work. It doesn't use electrons, and it doesn't use conductors.
I still, with one exception, follow Claude Chen and his comments about information bandwidth.
Okay.
I don't know what it was, 30s, 40s. Claude Shannon said the correlation between data rate and bandwidth is basically you need twice the bandwidth. The bandwidth has to be, twice the bandwidth associated with the highest frequency in the message. I disagree, because if you look into the details, if you did that literally, you could be sampling something only on the zero crossings. You know, if you have half the frequency, if you're sampling every, 360 degrees twice, what if you're always sampling 0 and 80, 0 and 80, 0 and 80, you get nothing? So the answer is not must be, but at least. So sooner or later, you get some. And I have a similar story, another kind of sort of related story.
Okay, I mean, you're kind of alluding to the Nyquist rate, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they all kind of go in the same package.
Yeah, okay, but like I said, there are interesting ways of getting around that by manipulating beam forwarding and directionality and such, but please do.
There are games you can play, but there is a limit. Let me give you an off-topic example. I work for a firm that built serious Doppler scan direction finders. And one thing they had learned over decades and decades is the bigger the antenna array, the less multi-path interference. If anybody listening has ever used an automobile Doppler scan, it only works while you're moving, so you can eyeball average the bobbling direction. You know what I'm saying? While you're moving and the multi-path changes, the angle that you're supposedly receiving from bobbles around, and you can eyeball average it. If you stop at a traffic light, you probably have the wrong bearing. In any event, at some competitive bid to the Federal Aviation Administration, some competitor said, no, they can get away with a very small antenna and make up for it with soft post-detection software processing. And our comment was, they are so full of it. But in any event, they brought up all kinds of consultants, all kinds of experts. They proved to the FAA that was right. Then the FAA, let me drop this. Then the FAA actually gave them an award for the entire production run, first production on the 75 units, which they then put out in the field. And then once they were out in the field, the reaction from the guys in the field was, get rid of this pile of garbage and give us back the old ones. It don't work. And they ended up with 75 of these magical wonder mystery toy units in a warehouse where they probably still are today.
AC2GS. Yeah, I understand that. I mean, that's the skepticism that I like to keep discussing when people present me with these innovative public relations releases on new technology that's going to change the world. It's not 100% nonsense. It's probably 98% nonsense. Occasionally, one or two of those things out of 100 has legs and moves on and accomplishes things. You got to sort of understand that a lot of these things are driven by people who have more emotional than intellectual things going on in the nature of why they're motivated, and sometimes it's just purely monetary. They're a research and development organization. They're looking for investment money, and if they give you optimistic promises, chances are you'll invest money, and they'll be able to siphon it off for their salaries and their bonuses and such. But, you know, that's always been sort of the nature of technology. You know, for every world-changing technological innovation, there are probably 100, if not maybe sometimes 1,000, that never pan out. You know, we discuss it, we used to discuss it every week on the Science Talk. How many times did I discuss how graphene might eventually change our world? Now, I'm still sitting here waiting on graphene.
Tuesday, it'll break.
I wish it would. You know, one of the many gotchas with graphene, as far as I'm aware, is production is a bitch. It you cannot produce it in the quantities and the sizes that you would need to build any of these amazing devices to a practical extent. Will this production limitation ever be cured? Maybe. Maybe not. Who knows? Yeah, I got a lot of problems with people misunderstanding that, you know, it's not like you're going to mine hydrogen. You got to make hydrogen. I mean, it's not that difficult to make hydrogen. You could use water and electrolysis. There's a lot of water. But then electrolysis is power. Where are you getting the power from? Well, coal, gasoline, you know, fossil fuels. So you're in the same mess. So, you know, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, unfortunately. But, yeah, there's I'm sure that Wesley is going to mention the hydrogen-based fueled airplanes. And in our government budget someplace is a sum to set up some kind of hydrogen repository station. So there are people deeply interested in hydrogen. Superficially, it's very clean. The details are awful, but you know, who wants to talk about the details?
Here is the point. I've been saying this for years. Hydrogen is an energy storage medium, kind of like a battery. You have to put in energy to not create hydrogen, but liberate hydrogen from it being held captive by oxygen and water, typically. So the idea being, you put in energy to create hydrogen, preferably renewable energy to create green hydrogen, and then you liberate it at the end use to go back to creating energy to do something. By the way, I believe as an aviation fuel is the best use of hydrogen, because the point is, fuel is a large part. I believe if you fly across the Pacific, that plane takes off with 50% of its total weight is fuel. So we're talking a lot, and they depend on the plane getting lighter as the fuel burns off, but they never make the range they make. So that's where the lightweight of hydrogen is a real benefit over fossil fuels, you know, the existing jet fuels, and why batteries are so terrible, because they never get lighter as you run out of, quote, fuel, unquote.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's basically like a battery. It's a redox reaction. You put in power to break the hydrogen-oxygen bonds, and then when you combust them to use the energy, you're left with water vapor, and you've returned it to its original form. But the big question is, where do you get the energy to break the water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen? Yeah, that's where the trouble is. But, yeah, I agree with you. Planes are probably the best suited if you had to figure out what kind of vehicle would be best with hydrogen versus the worst with batteries. Even trucks is an awful choice. These Tesla trucks, I hear, are a disaster. But then I also hear the Tesla wagons are going to be a disaster as well. So, yeah. But, yeah, I agree with you.
No, I think for things like trucks, biodiesel is a much more viable answer of the same genre.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. Matter of fact, I think there's a Tesla train that takes people from some common station to their facilities, and it uses biodiesel to an electrical generator, so they can use electric motors, but the power source is a diesel. Yeah, I mean, I think the ultimate solution, unfortunately, for these people who want a panacea is a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Things, you know, different technologies are better for different situations.
By the way, just an aside, you know, freight railroads have been using diesel to drive generators, to drive motors, for like over a century, I believe, in some cases. I think the point is, when you're dealing with like 5,000 horsepower, it's more efficient to have a generator and a motor than the necessary transmissions and linkages to get the power down to the wheels.
Yeah, I've never seen the specifics, but yeah, there's probably loads of good reason why businesses invest in that type of technology. And even, you know, when no one was really watching, Tesla used the same not-so-modern technology. You know, I assume if they wanted to, they could build a completely electrical train, but saner minds got their way, and it's a diesel-driven engine primarily.
Roy, what are you talking about? Look out your window. There's an electrically driven train.
Well, that's true, too, but it's a different circumstance. And it's not modern technology, either. It's been electric for many, 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 many years.
Ah, but the new ones use AC motors with a DC third rail.
Yeah, the motor technology has improved. Look, you know this neighborhood is as good as I do. McDonald Avenue still has little dents in the ground where trolley tracks used to be.
Yeah, they ran off of an overhead catenary. No, but in all seriousness, with the variable frequency drives, are the big things now for trains, railroads, subways, what they actually do is generate a variable frequency AC to an induction motor that tries to catch up to the drive frequency, and the classic, you know, donkey with the carrot on its string. As the speed picks up, so is the frequency, so it's always struggling to catch up until you reach the velocity you want.
Yeah, I mean, the improvements are great. The big problem that I have personally is that everyone kind of assumes that battery technology can be pushed as fast as other types of technology. The advances to solid-state electronics have been mind-numbing. It's just not possible with battery technology. You know, for all intents and purposes, we're dealing with the same chemistries that we've been dealing with for 20, 30 years. You know, lithium ion, I think Tesla is moving to lithium iron phosphate for the massive battery station substations that they sell countries. Batteries are not a panacea. Batteries have limited energy density and expenses, and you got to deal with them when they're used up and recycle them. There's a lot of technological problems with utilizing batteries rather than generators and, you know, standard diesel engines and other types of of fossil fuel-based engines to generate electrical power to run the electric motors for most of our electric vehicles.
By the way, I read an item about that. Wait, Shabbat.
Victoria, I'm going to have very little time to go over the subject.
Electric vehicles say when a battery is down to 70% of the original capacity, it has to be replaced. And some outfits are trying to see about picking up those used batteries and using them for ground-based power, saying, you know, 70% capacity is fine. You can get a couple of years out of them before you have to trash them completely. So that would be a bit of a benefit for lower-cost, you know, ground-based battery storage as opposed to mobiles.
Well, we'll have to see how that all settles out. I thank you, Ed, for your participation. Wesley feels that he's going to run out of time. I wasn't aware you were going to need more than about 40 minutes, but okay. So thank you, Ed. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. WB28.
No, I still have a time. It's just that I'm afraid that if it goes closer to 10 p.m., then I'm going to have very little time to go over the subject.
Okay, well, we'll jump in here anyway. You asked me my opinion. It's a very exciting. What basically it amounts to is that they've developed a very sensitive blood test, relatively inexpensive. They say $8 a shot. Takes a drop of blood. It sounds a little bit, unfortunately, like Theranos, which was a complete fraud. But legitimately, what it does is it has very sensitive ways of detecting a mutation on a gene that presents as a protein that is not usually found in human blood. So it's indicative of some kind of mutation. The problem, as I see it at this point, is that it's very nonspecific. It would suggest either precancerous or cancerous problems of about 120 different cancer lines. So should you look at the breast? Should you look at the ovaries? Should you look at the pancreas? Should you look at the colon? You'd be chasing all over the human body, and these could be microscopic abnormalities that produce positive blood test results, but don't kind of lend themselves to any kind of imaging technology. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done, but it's exciting new work, and it's good news, and I hope it is expanded upon, and I hope they develop other more specific tests for different cell lines.
Thank you very much for that information. The next subject is NASA Safety Advisory Panel has warned the agency that it might not be able to transition from International Space Station to Commercial Space Station in time to avoid leaving gap in America's presence in low Earth orbit, or LEO. Maybe Paul has some comments. Paul?
Very good, Wesley, and I read your email, and I saw that one. A couple of them, by the way, for some reason it blocked, but I got around that. I just took the topic and just went to a different website. The space station is expected to, it's funded until 2030, but what happens is other space stations that are on the drawing board that are coming up. Of course, you already have one up there. That's nothing to do with us. That's the China space station. But as far as we're concerned, we have Axiom there. They're presently building modules that are going to attach to the front of the space station. Eventually, there'll be like four of them. And when the time comes, they'll be able to separate from the space station and become their own space station. That's one plan. Another, Jeff Bezos plans on putting up something called the Orbital Reef. Orbital Reef will be this massive space station, which be able to, you'd be able to hold 10 people on board on a regular basis if they ever built that thing. They're involved with Sierra Nevada in creating that project. There's a new one called Space Lab. That's a collaboration between the United States and the European Space Agency. That one, I think, that one's got some chance of launching early enough. And there's a couple more on the drawing board as well. The problem is, will they make it up by 2030? And a lot of people say that I've read about. The writers believe that some of them think it's possible, and some of them don't. And depending on how they're funded and all, but you know, if you read the NASA stories with Bill Nelson. He's the NASA administrator. He's alluded to even extending the time frame from 2030 to 2034. And my guess is if they run into a jam, I think that's what they'll probably do. The United States has no intention of not having anybody up there with China going around the Earth every 90 minutes, that's for sure. You know, I wouldn't bet on it, but maybe I would bet on it. But I just want to put a lot of money on it. But I think that's what's probably going to happen, Wesley. I'm not really worried about it. Back to you.
Thank you very much for that. The next topic also to you. Scientists have trained an artificial AI system to accurately map in 1/100 of a second the surface area and outline giant iceberg captures on satellite images. It would be nothing special about it if it's not the fact that it's 10,000 times faster than that what is being done right now by human beings. So 10,000 times faster. My question is, should we understand that since it is right now taking place, it's not that it's going to take place in the future, it is real and now. Human being is going to be replaced. That means all of the melting of the ice is going to be tracked by satellites. Back to you.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there are going to be people looking at major iceberg problems in person or nearby. The problem is that they were working on computer algorithms that could scan satellite photographs that cover the Earth and detect and count and classify icebergs. Older technology didn't do it well. I think they had something like a 40% correct identification. This uses new artificial intelligence algorithms that are much better, but they still are only about 83%. So it's not perfect, and there will no doubt be other algorithms developed to bring that closer and closer to 100%. But I don't think that many people made their money, you know, were able to grow a family and do all these things by counting icebergs. I think it strikes me as an incredibly tedious labor that would not be fulfilling to most people. You know, back in the very old days, the way that they analyzed stars were by individuals. There was a woman, I think, at Harvard Astronomy that basically dedicated her life to looking at these plates that were produced by telescopes of the day. So, you know, some things are a little bit more drudgery than you want to do. You don't want to pick cotton, and you don't want to really count icebergs, personally. I don't.
Optimistic. Nice to see equipment coming to the job site. You know, you would be doing manually for years, and all of a sudden this thing would take over, and you would think, oh, this is going to be a problem for the man hours that are going to go in. But you know, sometimes it created other jobs, or you started doing other jobs that you weren't normally doing, and I think there's a there's a time factor involved. Anytime something new comes out, in this case, you know, something counting icebergs, you know, to replace people doing it. If it comes on too fast and you knock out thousands of people all at once, that's not good. If it comes in a little slow and, you know, some people drift off here and there and they find other jobs, then it's okay. You know, right now we have a workforce in this country that's down to, I think, 3% unemployment. You know, I think that's pretty good. You know, with a lot more people than in the 70s, and we had, in some cases, 20%, some industries, 50% that were out. And we had a lot less people then. So there's a lot to it. Again, I wouldn't worry about it. I think it's a good thing. In the long run, you have all this equipment doing stuff. We wouldn't be here today. I don't think a lot of us, if we didn't have the advances in technology that took place over the years. I think this is just another one. Anyway, back to you, Wes.
Thank you very much for that comment. Next question to both of you. Louisiana oil leak map as a toxic spill spread in Gulf of Mexico. So we have an estimated 1.1 million gallons of oil have leaked into Gulf of Mexico from pipeline that follows into Louisiana, prompting a multi-agency response. The main Pass oil gathering company, a subsidiary of Hudson, Texas-based Third Coast Infrastructure, which operates the pipeline, reported the leak at 8:10 a.m. on Thursday, November 16. So now we have a situation where that oil is taking over the coast. So I would love to hear both of you respond to that. So it's the National Transportation Safety Board involved, U.S. Coast Guard, and all other agencies. What is the situation, Dr. Reifert?
AC2GS. I don't know if there's that much I can comment. It's a terrible thing. It's not supposed to happen. Accidents though happen. You got to factor that into permits of running pipelines that can be damaged underground, because inevitably, if you wait long enough, they get damaged. And there's a lot of modern technology, surfactants, methods of scooping it up on the water. They're working on organisms that eat oil, but you know, it's a tragedy, and I hope it doesn't inflict too much damage on the ecosystem there. It's going to inflict some, but I don't know how much at this point. I hope we don't hear later on about oil-covered birds washing up to the shore and such.
Heard this report yet. It's the first time hearing of it. So I don't know how bad is it. You know, is it worse than the BP oil oil rig that they had problems with years ago. They couldn't cap it under the water. Remember that? That was a serious problem. Or Valdez. You know, we all lived through that one. You know, when that thing leaked all over the place. Really caused a lot of damage. But I haven't heard much about it. How bad is this thing back to the west?
Well, it looks like it's very bad right now. Is that right?
Well, yeah. Again, it's all on the Gulf of Mexico. It hasn't washed up to the shore yet. That's where you get a better idea of how terrible things are. They've sent ships out to skim the surface to reclaim as much oil as they can. It's an ongoing story. It's yet to be done.
Oh. I really don't have a further comment on it until I start reading about it. You know, what caused it, you know. Any options on how to fix it, the timetable of how long it's going to take. So, I mean, they're not going to stop doing what they're doing. Absolutely not. There's no way. Back to you.
Okay. So, from medical field. The first intense exercise. Some of you guys love to have an exercise. Not good. Very not good. It's not good for cold. And the intense exercise may lead to cold. Because it's changing your respiratory infection protective system. And you are many times more tend to get a cold than other people that do not exercise. It's from medic space escape. And it's from November 26, 2023. The article. So flu, COVID-19, and plenty of other things. That's one thing. And the second thing is your cats. Let me drop. Okay. I have 3 feral cats, and I have a 4th cat that is a domestic cat, but I'm feeding 3 feral cats for years already. And we're taking care of them. If they're sick, we have to somehow catch them, get them to the vet and whatsoever. But there is a problem with that. T. gondii seropositives, there are significant positive association between the T. gondii IJJ sero intensity and ferality, accounting for the edge of not only dangerous to pregnant women but older people too. That means you're playing with your cat and you're most likely gonna get all of those respiratory infections from the cat. The copy of the article was sent to Dr. Roy. I would love him to comment on it. Thank you.
I'm not quite sure which article that even was. I mean, cats usually are carriers for parasitic infections that used to be thought that affect people with HIV. Matter of fact, there was a subplot, and we mentioned it before, of I forget. It's an English movie about heroin addicts. One of them became an HIV, developed HIV and had, was given a pet cat, and cryptosporidium infection killed him. There's some belief that cryptosporidium can produce inflammatory responses in human beings that make them somewhat frail as time progresses. It's a more indolent sub-infection. I think that's what you're alluding to. I'm not quite sure.
Well, based on the articles, there are actually two links that I have sent you. One is about changing the immunity status of the older people and, of everybody who is exercising, physically exercising outside into, so intense exercise may lead into cold, but actually it's to any respiratory disease. That's the first one. The second one says about playing with cats or other domestic animals, and that becomes very much dangerous to the people in age. But also, it was previously thought that it is not good for pregnant women, but now they find out that it is also for people in age, so old timers. Most of us are 60-plus, to be kind. Back to you, Dr. Ross.
Okay, you got to keep in mind that Wesley sent me 12 emails in about an hour and a half before the technical net, so I guess I missed that particular one. You got to take these things with a grain of salt. Too much of anything is not good for you. Too much water will kill you. Too much exercise can kill you. Exercise generally, even though I tend to be a lazy person, is good for you. Too much exercise, too much running can accelerate osteoarthritis and give you joint problems. You breathe in more rapidly to get the oxygen. If you do it in an environment with cold temperatures and low humidity, you dry out your mucosa and you kind of make your respiratory system a little bit less likely to trap viral particles, and you might get an increased infectious rate. But, you know, as I keep saying, all things in moderation. If you exercise rationally and reasonably, it's beneficial. It's not detrimental.
Okay, thank you for that. So the second one was about the wild animal, not wild animal, domestic animals, and we can get diseases from them through the respiratory system. Back to you.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. Cats have toxoplasmosis, which usually, again, people with good immune systems don't have a problem. HIV people have died of toxoplasmosis that they caught from their pet cats in the past. And, you know, there are other diseases, obviously, that dogs and cats can not fully give you a subacute episode where you don't have significant immediate symptoms, but they can cause inflammatory processes in your body that could lead to more indolent problems over a lifespan.
Thank you for that. The next one. You probably noticed that so many Teslas are on the streets right now, and the Amazon starts to use hundreds or maybe thousands of electric vans, which is the direct competition to Tesla. I was able to see only Volt. There was another competition to Tesla, but only a few of them over the last 2 years. But Teslas are really popular. Now, every fourth car sold is electric in California. The information is from November 24, 2023. I'm going to go to the article right now. NASA remains king in U.S. with 50% share of EV market as a big car maker. Bloomberg was pointing...